point in a retreat when everyone is still here, you know? It's like 2 hard days, you know? A lot of ups and downs that sort of don't seem like they're really based on much if you look outside of ourselves, you know, that there's a, that's when you start to kind of, you get that sense of why it's so hard to explain this kind of experience to other people who don't do this, who don't go on retreat, or how just not having been on retreat, if you're here for the first time for this kind of thing, just like that, there's that kind of level of incomprehensibility to, you know, the sun comes up, or we get up, you know, the sun comes up, we're sitting and walking through the day, there's meals, you hear a few other voices, and that's pretty much it. And yet somehow we end up on this just roller coaster, you know, incredible. Not always, you know, sometimes, and again, some of it's our own sort of personality type, some of it's our sort of, you know, practice history, some of it is totally unfathomable of how each retreat ends up being. But in general, you know, you're going to have some level of change, some swings, some ups and downs, some feeling like things are really going your way, sometimes feeling like it's totally impossible. And all because of why, you know, what, where is it coming from? It's amazing. You know, it's amazing to watch these challenges, these hard moments, these storms, these weather patterns move through. Not always clear kind of what leads to them, where they're coming from, why they go away. But that even we have somehow enough resolve, enough confidence in ourselves, enough, we're in a remote enough place that's hard to get home from, that we stay, you know, and we stick it out. And sometimes it's feels valiant, and sometimes it feels like we've barely, you know, we're crawling to the finish line each in the evening. But either way, it's just important to kind of acknowledge the effort that you've put through, you know, put in through the day. And while it, you know, may sort of be in or out of balance, we may feel like our actions may have been sort of more or less skillful, that we can have some faith in the goodness of it, right? The intention, the motivation that got us here, that keeps us connected, keeps us going. It's always helpful to get the reminder, especially for folks, I think, who haven't been on this kind of experience before and haven't been on a more intensive retreat, the reminder of just that there are certain factors of mind, certain experiences that are, we tend to call the hindrances, that are really totally expected, right? That we expect that they arise, we anticipate it, and we, a big part, particularly in the first few days of a retreat, as our concentration is kind of just getting going, and we're, you know, just sort of starting to arrive, that these things tend to, they can play a big part in the flavor of our day. One or more of them at any given time can really arise, you know, sometimes very subtly, sometimes really in the background, hard to see, sometimes with a lot of ferocity. you know, the first is craving, greed, wanting, just on that sort of, that basic level of wanting that which we don't have in the moment. The second is aversion or anger, frustration, that sort of realm of experiences. Then there's sloth and torpor. Sometimes that's, you know, plenty of us have that sense of obviously like sleepiness and some level of exhaustion, or you're, you know, you're just in the hall and there's that kind of nodding off. But it's also, it also means that, that just that, that kind of deeper lethargy of you hear the bell rings and there's this immediate like, oh, I really, you know, that resistance to going into the hall, right? The resistance to kind of like putting in any more effort. Then you've got restlessness and worry. Just the degree to which sometimes it's just, you know, our minds can be really wild. The sort of energy in our bodies can feel really overwhelming. Sometimes that feeling of wanting to run out of the hall because we can't contain it in our bodies. And doubt. Doubt in ourselves, doubt in the practice, doubt in this place, doubt in this form, doubt in the teachers. Doubt in our ability to do this, right? To grow the capacity of the heart, to strengthen it. You know, we call them the hindrances, and there is a way that that, you know, the fact of them being a real, they can be perceived as an obstacle. You know, it can be helpful, right, that we also see that they're not personal. On the other hand, it's also important to really see how they are our system's natural response, learned and trained response to trying to practice, to trying to bring the mind to concentration, to bring the mind to wholesome qualities, to sort of be to doing this, you know, that we don't appreciate them as like defenses against reality, that we have learned that over you know, our lifetimes, over eons, there's been this process of intentionally or unintentionally learning these mechanisms to resist, to protect ourselves from the instability of life, from the constant fluctuation, from the constant change, from the disappointment, from the hardships, that these are the heart's response to try to protect ourselves, right? The sleepiness, the restlessness, the you know, the aversion, the wanting. It's this sense of like that things are so unstable that this is how our hearts have learned to protect themselves. And we so don't appreciate them most of the time, right? We don't value that we've learned that our hearts are trying to protect us in the only way they've learned how. Right? That we actually haven't had this training of how to relate to reality with kindness, how to relate to it with understanding and interest. In fact, we've learned sort of all these opposite things over our lifetimes. You look at, you know, the wildness of all the beings here, you know, and it's a good, it's such a good reminder that, you know, the human can think of itself as so distinct from nature, as outside of that process, as more, you know, having some, you know, it is part of the arrogance of our species. That's a, obviously a problem on many levels, but even on this level of like getting, it's like when you look at, you know, the animals who are living in the wild, as we call it, you know, there is they may be beautiful, they may be inspiring, we may be moved and feel blessed by their presence. But there's another level where you see it's like they're living in a panic, right? They're afraid of what's hunting them. They are constantly trying to find food to sustain themselves, right? These deep patterns of craving and aversion are natural. They are what have actually gotten us here through eons of evolution to survive. And we treat them as if they're just like these ignorant, horrible parts of ourselves that like just don't deserve any space, any room to breathe. And then we come on retreat and we're like, okay, that's wrong. We're going to do this instead. Just, we're going to forget all that. We're just going to love everything. And that is such a crazy, like, it's a beautiful intention, right? That it's like, this is such a beautiful, we actually do have the capacity to break out of that cycle, right? To not be oppressed moment by moment by greed, hatred, and delusion. To be constantly living in this panic and this worry and this fear or this wanting or this craving, having that be what's motivating our lives. But it's not going to just shift because we decide that it's better, right? This is, it's, you know, however you relate to lifetimes or just evolution, you know, it's like this is such a deep part of what it means to be alive. It is why that's like that dukkha, suffering, is such a palpable, inherent aspect of what it means to exist. Because there's this need to keep existing, right? The need to protect ourselves, the need to get what we want, what we need to survive. So when the Buddha said, you know, hatred is never allayed by hatred, it's allayed by love. That's what we start to see with these hindrances, you know, when they arise, when we're confronted with incredible sleepiness or incredible aversion or just overwhelming waves of doubt. There's this sense of like, oh, can we actually respect the resistance? Can we respect these wild parts of ourselves as natural, not necessarily wise, right? Not necessarily skillful, not necessarily the things we want to be beholden to ultimately, but also not ridiculous, right? Not worthless. There's a reason why these exist, and they've come to protect us. And so they, at the very least, they deserve a little bit of credit for having gotten us as far as they have. And yeah, we don't want to be beholden to them. You know, we want to be able to move beyond them, liberate ourselves from those mechanisms, find ways that are more skillful, relationship to the wildness of life, the unpredictability of things. So in this context of the metta retreat, we really actually have a very important tool, and the whole purpose of this retreat actually fits in wonderfully into a way to kind of relate to some of these phenomena as they arise. You know, so when we feel craving, we feel wanting, when there's, you know, sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's more intense, you know, sometimes it is around the food line, you know, at lunch, and you know, it's our most tangible time of noticing wanting, you know, noticing the sort of anxiety of what's happening. And with this metta practice, it's, you know, we can tune into just the fact that that is painful in our hearts. Michelle mentioned this the other day. It's like noticing that wanting, that contraction of the heart around, it is dukkha. It is painful. And just on that level, we can start to try to bring kindness to it, right? It's that the flavor of kindness oriented toward pain, toward suffering, is, you know, we often call compassion. But it's that same quality of kindness. It's like, oh, right, we don't beat ourselves up for wanting, right? We don't say, oh, you shouldn't want it. We don't buy in to the perhaps aversion or annoyance with how slow people in front of us might be in line. But you go into that sort of painful place of the heart and you bring some kindness to it. Ow, right? It's part of that process of taking responsibility for our own minds, our own heart's response to reality. and not taking responsibility in the sense of like, oh, it's your fault, but of the sense of like, oh, I can attend to this in a way that's going to bring kindness and compassion, right? So we bring that. And then perhaps in our actions, perhaps there's then this, even if it's not a visible action or a verbal action, but the sense of, okay, you're going to, this generosity of heart, you're letting this person take the time and space that they need to open the door as slowly as they need to, or to bang the door if they do, whatever it is, that's either, or wanting other people to behave differently than they are. It's like, oh, okay, we see that it's actually our own heart that's having the hardship and projecting it outwards, because it's actually really hard to feel that. So we just, we commit to trying to feel it and care about it. Same with aversion, right? Anger, frustration, the sense of not wanting. It also hurts, you know, it hurts in the heart to feel that. And so it's that carefulness of like, oh, we're not trying to shut down the heart. We're not trying to stop aversion from happening. You can't transform something you don't have a relationship with, right? You can't, something won't change until we understand it. And we have to understand it with this quality of kindness. So that sense of, pain in our own hearts, the dukkha of it, bring some love and kindness. Sometimes, particularly if we're trying to really recall people that we feel kindness toward, you know, we're trying to get this practice going in whatever way, whatever method we end up using, you know, kind of like we've talked about, there are times where it brings up more complicated aspects of relationship. Sometimes our aversion towards other people's actions, you know, arises in us. And again, it's like we can trace that back. It's like, oh, it's disappointment. It's feeling hurt. It's feeling, you know, it's like, it's not about them. We don't need to try to send metta to that person yet. It's about, oh, this is where the pain is. This is where we send metta. If you attune to the pain in someone else, you attune to the sort of causal factors of their own unskillful actions, for example, then yeah, sure, we can try to send metta to that because it's coming from a genuine place. It's not sending metta because you want to love the person and you think you should love the person. You think that you're trying to fix them with your love and kindness, that somehow if you love them more, they'll be the person you want them to be, right? It's like, no, this is just, we're trying to find that genuine, conditionless caring through their happiness, through their sorrow, just through their own worthiness, wherever we can kind of connect with that. And then other times we might have recall our own unskillful actions, right? The sense of remorse, of regret, of knowing that here's someone we care about and we actually have maybe harmed them. It's a very powerful experience and one that is important, but also that we need to be very careful with, right? That it is important to reckon with the fact that our actions have results, that we actually have the capacity to harm ourselves and other people. And to know that that causing pain for ourselves or others, it leaves this echo in the heart, right? It leaves this residual effect. It's karma, right? It's this sense of like guilt that can last, this feeling bad. It's important if it's information that motivates us to try our best to act out of kindness, to try our best to act out of generosity, out of wisdom, out of caring. We need to be very careful. It's sort of, if it pulls us into spirals, right, of doubt, of self-hatred, of self-judgment, that's not going to be helpful. And the Buddha was very explicit about like getting people out of that, like pulling people out of those cycles, because they're not helpful. There's a helpfulness to sort of reckoning the impact of our actions, but that we also need to use that energy to kind of motivate us to be more skillful, more caring. a sloth and torpor, it's the same, you know, the sense of recognizing it as dukkha, caring for it. That can be like our initial, you know, it's like, okay, that part we can kind of, you can develop that muscle, you know. Oh, we don't like what's happening. It's dukkha, caring. If we could develop that, like just that capacity, that would take us pretty far. So just remember that there's something very simple. It's like, oh, I don't like what's happening. It's painful. I can care about it. And then, you know, to not worry about it. And a big thing is like, you know, this, the idea that we're trying to cultivate a kindness that is free from conditions, that it doesn't matter what is happening, and we still have access to this capacity of the heart, that part of what that means is that we can be kind and sleepy, right? It doesn't mean that we have to have all of the conditions perfect for kindness to arise. It's actually the opposite of that. It means that we have access to kindness no matter what's happening, right? So that even in sleepiness and that very edge of totally somewhere else, it's like, yes, actually the heart can still connect to kindness. Sometimes it's kind to let yourself take a nap, to take a break, right? To sort of step off the gas. So we, you know, we're not trying to fight reality. We're trying to bring this approach of tenderness, tenderheartedness toward it. And the same with restlessness and worry, you know, this, whether it's in the body, again, it's happening, it's unpleasant, caring. It's happening, we don't like it, it's caring. You know, and then just this question of like, wow, you know, a lot of times restlessness will manifest in terms of just a lot of thinking. You know, that you're sitting here and you're trying to focus on how much you think you're supposed to love somebody. And then, you know, all you're doing is thinking about some other thing that has nothing to do with it, you know. And it's just, it can be so frustrating. We think that our thoughts are in the way, that they're the problem. If only the mind would settle down, then we could practice loving kindness. And it's just not true. We think they're a problem because we're not seeing them clearly. Do we look at the night sky and see a shooting star and be like, oh God, I wish that would stop. You know, I just wish things would just stop moving. No, you have wonder. You're like, wow, that's amazing. It's so beautiful. I feel fortunate to have seen that. How are our thoughts different than that? These mysterious, magical, ethereal phenomena zipping by in this kind of vast sky space of the heart and mind, they're amazing. They're incredible. We hate them, right? We just want them to go away and stop. And it's just not fair. And it's only because we're not seeing them well. It's happening so fast that we can't keep up. And so we can't keep up and we get frustrated and we get caught in them. You know, and they perpetuate unseen. That's why we're developing these skills, the concentration, you know, that's like we're trying to learn how to keep up with reality as fast as it's moving, which is very, very, very fast. But we have this capacity to keep up with it and bring kindness to it each moment, right? Each moment zipping by. The heart can develop that degree of strength, of suppleness, of attunement. I often have a really great regular opportunity to practice trying to be kind with all the hindrances and all the defilements. Every time I come to Canada, because every time I come to Canada, they put me in the when I go through customs, they put me in like the special line. Not the good special line. The, like, back room, right? And it's, you know, Canadians don't always want to hear that, like, you have very hardcore agents at the border. But you do. And they're protecting your country with a lot of diligence. Yeah, from me. Yeah, it's really every time, it started a bunch of years ago, and it's just they look at me and they just know something's not right. They're just like, they pretend to listen. They're like, okay, and they're writing whatever on the card, and they're like, bring this to the guy, you know. So you end up in this room where you've just got tons of people who are ready to go home or visit their families or whatever, show back up out of this room. And then, a number of security agents who are kind of interviewing people one at a time, but it's all very public. So, you've got this sort of long line of people, and then you can't quite tell where. Sometimes there's like a ton of these, border agents out, and then they move into other rooms and they come out and they switch places. There's a whole thing going on, but anyway, it's at some point I'll get it, because you do it enough. But it's very, very, very intense, and because you can watch them kind of really interrogating people. And it's designed to be public. It's designed to be intense for that way, right? You're supposed to be seeing how much of a hard time they're giving everyone. And then it makes, by the time you're there, you're like, ready to admit to all kinds of things that you haven't done. But it was like, oh my God, this poor guy's family. And she's like, what is this? Dried pork products. And he's like, chicharrones, right? And she's like, no. There are no chicharrones in Canada. You will not bring chicharrones in, right? I was like, wow, okay, intense. And this lady, she had a bunch of sardine cans, and they're like, you are smuggling, And this old lady, I don't know. She's like, bring us just like cans of sardines, And you're like, okay. Oh, man. And so you just see it on all ends. Like everyone in line is just stressed. Everyone who's in the thing is stressed. The agents are stressed. Everyone is just, it's all defilements all day long, And it's these things, like, you can just see some people are distressed. They're sitting, because at the end of the line, there are some chairs, So the people who've been waiting forever, when they're about to actually get in, they get to, and you can just see some people are just, you're exhausted by this process of just waiting. For the hour or whatever you're actually just waiting or, and then other people, it's just this, this anxiety and worry and fear, and the, aversion and the aggressiveness and, and even, and it's just, and then of course there are sometimes people who are trying to do bad things, right? And so there's a reason for it. We this time it was great. There were these two guys and they were just like, these two agents were just like, okay, like, are these your bags? And there was just like no answer, And they were like, do you recognize these bags? And they were like, they have your name on them. Are these your bags? And they were like, did you pack these bags? They were like, who has the key? So you're like, okay, those guys might be in trouble, Whatever's going on there. We got sent out before we found out what was in the bags. So they brought out like the big plot. They were gonna break the lock, and it was a whole thing. Finally, you're kind of interested. Something's going on. You're like, okay, this is kind of interesting. And then they didn't get out. Go teach your retreat. Okay. Oh man, but it has become it's a great example of how it is not perfect conditions to be practicing loving kindness for these things, the aversion, the greed, the frustration, the worry, the all of it, the doubt. And yet, I've been through it enough that the approach is different. It isn't to say that I still don't go through my frustration, my aversion, my nervousness, whatever. All those things still happen, but there's a much increased capacity to really just feel kindness toward people, to the people who are really scared and who are, who may not speak the language well and who are very intimidated by what's happening and are really just trying to visit their families. To the guards who are, who I do believe are generally really motivated to try to protect, and try to create a safe society here, and protect the borders and protect the boundaries, you know, we do that here. We have our precepts. We have our, you know, every monastery you go to in Burma, you know, at the gates of it, there are dragons or there are lions or there is something about protecting a space, you know, that requires a degree of intensity, you know. And, you know, we have Aaron, which is wonderful, you know. Yeah. But you see, you know, you come to see, it's a very powerful place for me to see. It's like, okay, this is, it's a yearly thing, you know, where I can have this experience again and again and be so fortunate to like see the capacity change, you know. And a big part of it is just familiarity, you know, that if you've been on retreats a bunch of times, you can see it isn't that these things stop happening. The hindrances don't necessarily stop happening when you try to go from daily life onto retreat life. But our familiarity with them makes them less troublesome, right? Less turbulent a situation they create for us. And so that even within it, we have more flexibility of heart to be interested, to be mindful, to be kind, to be gentle, to be generous, that they're not sort of rocking the boat quite as deeply. And so, you know, I almost really feel like this time it was like, oh, this was an honest to goodness, deep experience, you know, that actually provided me with a lot of, just kind of like meaningful sense of connection and compassion for a lot of people, you know. Actually fortunate, because not everyone gets sent to the back room. May you all be sent to the back. May all beings be sent to the back room someday. And be innocent of any wrongdoing. But even so, you know, even with the familiarity, it's hard. You know, we sit here moment by moment and just do our sitting, we do our walking, we try our best, and it's, you know, the mind is still so wild and the terrain so rocky at times. One of the things I noticed this year in Burma, we had a new Seda leading the retreat with Stephen and Michelle. And so he didn't know that part of Burma as well. And so there was sort of some effort to kind of take him around to show him a few things. And so I got to go on a few excursions with him. And we actually went to the sort of home town and home temple of Mahasi Sayadaw, who was sort of the main teacher from, you know, our lineage. And it was really powerful that he, first of all, it's a beautiful place, it's very quiet, but there's all these beautiful colors. Like one huge temple part of it is painted this like bright pink, and one is painted bright green, and one is painted bright blue. It's like not sort of subdued in the way you might imagine. It's very vibrant, very colorful. And, you know, Mahasi means a big drum. That was the name he was given, because this temple has this enormous drum in it. Not quite as wide as this room, but long. And I started to kind of pay more attention that, you know, all the monasteries and nunneries have both these drums. They have drums and they have bells, and they're to me, it's like a kind of deep recognition of sort of both of these kinds of energies that we need to move forward, you know, and these huge drums, you know, it's boom boom, you know, that the heartbeat, the rhythm of kind of like, okay, that level of concentration, that persistent quality of applied energy, you know, of just like the keeping going. Not strained, not stressed, but consistent, solid, strong. then the bells, you know, that the sort of transcendent, light, beautiful, airy quality, you know, that comes with that at the end of a sitting at different times, you know, and they'll use each of these for different reasons. And that recognition of needing both, you know, needing the concentration, because this is the, you know, the classic way that the hindrances are dealt with really have mostly to do with just concentration, right? It's not personal. It's just that over time you apply this energy, you keep bringing the mind back to what's happening, keep bringing it back to loving kindness, that just the factors of concentration basically kind of subdue or suppress the hindrances for a time, right? They don't permanently eradicate them, but they kind of push them down enough so that we get a little bit of breathing room. And the where we live on the Big Island, you know, there are these trade winds that are pretty consistently blowing, and there's this sort of steadiness to them. When they stop, the kind of volcanic smog, the vog from the volcano, really kind of goes everywhere, and it's kind of hard, you know, the eyes itch, you get a headache. It's called the sickness winds, this cone of weather. And so you can't wait for the trades to come back, you know, and it's just this sense of like, well, when these steady, slow, consistent winds come back, they push that vog out to sea, you know. And so that's, you know, this concentration is developing that quality. Just that gentle, continued application. So slowly, you know, part of it's like we're relating to it in kindness on an individual level. Part of it is that we're just that gentle, continued application starts to sort of keep them at bay so that we develop a little bit of room to breathe over time, a little bit of sense of space, a little bit of clarity, a little more energy, a little less tumult. You know, when the Buddha was trying his hardest to liberate the mind, you know, from suffering, he tried all these different practices, and a lot of his energies were put towards like very intense straining and striving and practices that cause a lot of physical pain and mental anguish, and you know, he could see that there were you know, they created very powerful experiences at times, but they were also exhausting and deflating, didn't lead to wisdom, didn't ultimately uproot these problems. And he said, you know, one day, he said, I recall once when my father, the Sakyan, was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of the rose apple tree, secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful mental qualities. I entered the deep, absorptive concentration. Talks about the kind of deep natural capacity to enter very concentrated places. And you can see it's like this isn't like he remembered a time as a kid where he, you know, pushed himself into, you know, attaining some luminous quality of mind. It was like this gentle, he was sitting under the shade of the rose apple tree, watching his father work, and you know, just kind of in what has that quality of feeling like a very quiet, calm, natural, restful connection with, you know, himself, or, you know, whatever it was that pulled him in. Just remembering, it's like, yes, we're doing this, you know, we're applying this energy over time, we're keep bringing it back, but it needs to have this quality of carefulness, of tenderness, of non-striving. And you can see that anytime you're trying to bring loving kindness to something, you can attune to like, what does it feel like is motivating it? Sometimes, you know, we can be trying to send loving kindness, but you can notice that really what's underneath it is just like a desperation or an exhaustion or frustration or just a contraction of the heart, you know, trying to make this happen, trying to push. You have to be very careful about that, coming back into a more restful, relaxed approach. It does take energy. Absolutely. You know that. You've been doing it, right? It's like, okay, yeah, you're tired by the end of the day. But you have to be very careful that that energy isn't cultivating more unwholesome mental states, states that are opposed to mindfulness, states that will actually hinder its flourishing. One of the reasons we like to teach metta in this way, that is not pushing so hard, and just to say, you know, that there's a range of a huge range of people here with, you know, we just have our different minds and our different hearts and our different life experiences and our different range of experiences in terms of practice. And so, you know, there might be that you have this time here and you want to practice in a more kind of concentrated way, you know, where you were really doing more of the kind of classical metta practice, you know, where you're really focusing on one person over the course of a day and continuing to bring that quality to them. That's fine. You know, if that is what you want to be doing and that's sort of your approach here, it's like we support that. When you have this kind of space to practice, sometimes that's appropriate, you know, to try to practice in that way. We still would say, do it with this gentleness, do it with this quality of carefulness, of restfulness, of not pushing. But that we also really encourage this approach to metta, to loving kindness, that also has the capacity to be very integrated into the wisdom practice, into Vipassana. And the way that we sort of encourage that is really to relate to this metta practice as a kind of exploration. You know, that on one hand, our hearts know what loving kindness is. On another hand, maybe we don't know with a lot of refinement, you know. And so a lot of this process, as we recall someone and try to bring them to mind, or you know, attuned to this sort of capacity to kindness with our bodies, a lot of it is just this exploration of, like, is this metta or is this not metta? Is this a loving kindness that's strong, that's soft, right? Sometimes we have this hope, we call them immeasurable, the immeasurables. And, you know, that's a translation that's true. It's not to say that we're all going to leave here, like, you know, radiating, you know, sunlight and flowers are going to arise in our path as we walk. You know, I mean, there's some perhaps fantasy of that at some point, that this, the capacity of loving kindness to be boundless, to be immeasurable is real, right? Because it's not based on conditions. It's not personal. Therefore, there's like nothing inhibiting it, right? It's not our metta for this thing. It's just this, you know, attunement to the fact of metta, the heart's capacity. But also just like any small drop of it is immeasurable. It's not that it's necessarily always going to be immeasurable in our persistent capacity, but it's this like any small drop of loving kindness that we taste, it's so deeply, we're so deeply thirsty for it. We don't even always know that. But when you feel it and you let it sink in, it's like this relief. It's, you know, that sense of, you know, there is no relief like that sense of rain in the desert. And that's what it feels like. It's just like that sometimes it feels like our heart is this desert, so thirsty for our own kindness. When we can provide even just a little bit of taste for it, it's incredibly powerful, immeasurably powerful. So it's this discerning process, you know, and it's why these two things work together so beautifully, the love and the wisdom, you know, that for me, the time that I feel like I learned so much that I had done enough practice and prepared my heart for this sort of capacity to learn. Because you sit here and you're trying to do it, and sometimes it can't always feel. It doesn't always feel significant. We're conjuring up something that we're trying to find a connection to. It sometimes is hard to sort of feel like, how is this related to the bigger picture? But when my father was dying, that was a time where I started to, like, I finally had this experience of saying, oh, okay, I get it, right? I get this attempt at trying to, how do we stay connected to loving and losing at the same time, right? How do we have this very powerful range of grief and sadness and frustration and all of the things that will come around a situation like that, where someone we care about is dying, do we still have the capacity to connect to this sense of pure kindness, to pure caring? Not to say grief doesn't happen, not to say sadness doesn't happen, frustration, exhaustion doesn't happen. These things still happen. But have we developed a taste for loving kindness, right? Do we know the flavor? Have we sort of searched the realms of the heart and mind, found the things that are similar but not, a kind of love that's more controlling, a kind of love that's more lustful, a kind of more, you know, just all those realms, and finding that way, that flavor of actual kindness, unconditional love? When you develop a taste for it, it's easier and easier. You know, we build that groove, that we find that thread to it. You can find your way back more easily. The more you look for it, the more you find it. And it's just in these little drops, right? You mostly get it in these small doses, but it builds, you know, it builds that channel slowly, withering away everything else around it. And so this experience, you know, with my dad, of just watching how, yeah, I was so fortunate to be able to have this practice, right? To watch the grief, to feel the grief, to you know, include everything, all the other crazy family things that happen around a situation like that, of course, you know, the longing, the sadness, and still find that sense of connection, still find that pure caring, and see that actually, even as he died, that sense of connection could grow, that it was a caring unshaken by change. That is what we're doing. That is what we're learning to do. An unperturbable loving kindness, not dependent upon conditions. Things change, things arise, things pass, things are pleasant, things are unpleasant, and that the heart has this capacity, even if it's just with one person for a little while, to keep that connection going. And you'll see that here. You know, you'll see that in small moments where you'll have a sense of kindness, something unpleasant about the person will arise, and you'll lose it. But then other times, something unpleasant will arise and you won't lose it. Or you'll get sort of pulled into it, but you'll still have held on to that thread of kindness, and you find your way back. This training, this plays out on very subtle levels. So that, when you can do that, when you're feeling kindness towards someone, something comes up and it starts to kind of tremble and shake and move it a little bit away, and you find just enough of it to keep connected to and come back, that is just an enormous accomplishment. That one moment of strengthening that bond has immeasurable power, because it's like that faith that develops. And we have to recognize it. It's important to recognize it and give ourselves credit for when it happens, because it develops our faith, this belief in our capacity to do this, especially when things feel very difficult, feel very hard, you know, where it feels almost impossible. We can come back on that sense of faith, the belief in our own heart's capacity to care no matter what. So yeah, I just, you know, a final encouragement in that same vein, you know, of when things get hard, and of course they may have already, they may continue to be hard, they may get harder, they may get less hard, we don't know. But just know, you know, when it does, and we feel like we've lost a sense of our connection to kindness, perhaps our own faith in ourselves feels distant, or there's a veil between it. Just always remember, you know, there's our precepts, right? We have taken these precepts. You have for these, whatever point that happens, you know, so far it's 2 days where you have committed to non-harming, right? Where you have been extremely careful with your actions, with yourselves and with others. That is a beautiful foundation to come back to, right? It's a kind of refuge. Remembering your own goodness in that. Remembering this community of practice that we have here, the supportive, you know, sometimes when we don't think we can go on and you just see someone doing walking meditation early in the morning or late at night, it can inspire us. It can motivate us. You know, we can feel like, okay, if they can do it, I can do it. We're doing this together. Just remember that, you know. And then, you know, we're so blessed to be in this place with such natural beauty and all these other, we're so outnumbered by other beings. It's wonderful. It's a relief. This place can hold your grief, the sky, the ocean, the forest. It is not troubled by your anger or your sadness. You know, it doesn't have to be the sense of we're holding this all in. It's not in this. It's just around. We don't have to personalize it. Its existence, and we don't have to personalize its kind of containment, you know, where we take the blessing and the goodness and the spaciousness and the power of this place as a support, you know, for our own minds and hearts and bodies. So yeah, just moment by moment, we just keep going. Just getting in, it's great. It's really wonderful. You know, I just feel like wonderful to speak with folks today. And I know for all of us, it just felt like, okay, you know, this good feeling. People are doing it. Everyone's doing great, you know, really. So we continue to be very happy to be here with you and looking forward to this evening and tomorrow. Let's sit for a moment.